Morning. Today's daf Mabamaser is Kuf Samech Vav. Learning we do this morning should be for a Refuah Shleima for Baruch Zvi Ben Rivka Basia. We'll start with the Mishnah. The Mishnah is on Kuf Samech Beis. The Mishnah deals with the following. Again, 10th parak of Mabamaser. We're talking about contract law. It's the totality of the discussion of the 10th parak. We are going through many details regarding the writing of the contract, meaning since the beginning of the parak on Kuf Samech, we talked about the just the general design of what a contract would look like. There are two different types of contracts. There's a get pashut, there's a get makusha. Get pashut is what we would look at as a simple contract. You have the text, you have the signatures on the bottom of the text, and then a certification below that, below the signatures. And then you had a get makusha. Get makusha was much more complicated. By design, it was a complex document where writing was on one side, signing was on the other side, folds, tying, stitching. So it was a much more dating was different. So it was a much more complicated procedure. And by design, the entire institution of the get makusha was designed for kohanim who needed more time. You know, intentionally needed more time before divorcing their wives. So, but once the get makusha was designed, so then it could be used for all different types of transactions as well. It now became a valid form of writing up a document. That is what we've been discussing since the beginning of the parak. So from Kuf Samach to today's daf Kuf Samach Vav, really the Mishnah on Kuf Samach Hem and Beis. So that's been the topic of discussion. We now continue in the Gemara with the next Mishnah. The next Mishnah, which we're about to start, is now going to talk about discrepancies in the contract itself. So, the contract either has omissions or discrepancies. And what the Mishnah is going to be discussing now in the course of today's daf is, how do we handle omissions, how do we handle discrepancies? So the Mishnah starts off, Kasevo Zuzin Mea De Inun Salain Isrin. So the contract says that it's an IOU, it's a note, and the note says that how much is owed? So 100 zuz, which is 20 salaim. Now 100 zuz is not 20 salaim. Every seller is worth 4 zuzim. So if there was going to be agreement to the contract, it would say 100 zuz, which is 25 salaim. But that's not what the contract says. It says 100 zuz, which is 20. So that's obviously a discrepancy. And 20 dinarim come out to 80 zuz. So effectively what you have in this contract is two different numbers, basically. It's 100 or it's 80. So what do you do? So ain't lo elas yisum zuzin. So in terms of the note's still going to be a valid note, meaning even though there's a discrepancy, we're not going to invalidate the note. We're not throwing out the note. But what we are going to do, however, is that we're going to award the note holder the lesser of the two numbers. Now, this is a theme that we've been discussing again and again. It's one of the most basic laws when it comes to monetary law, and that is amotzi mechaver al averaya. When extracting money from somebody, the only way I can take money away from somebody else is if I know definitively that he owes me the money. And when I say definitively, meaning it has to be proof positive. It cannot be any kind of ambiguity in terms of him owing me the money. I think he owes me the money, simply not enough to extract money out of somebody else's hand. Here, when there are two numbers on the document, so look, which one does he owe me, 80 or 100? Well, there is a common denominator. The common denominator of 80 and 100 is 80. So I can take 80 out of him, but I can't take the remaining 20. And again, the reason why I can't take the remaining 20 is because I don't know. I don't know for sure he owes it to me. Mishnah is going to give a second example, which is basically the same idea. So let's say I write down 100 zuz, which is 30 salaim. Now again, 30 salaim is 30 times 4 is 120. So here there are two numbers on the document. One is 100 and the other one is 120. So ein lo alamana. So once again, the rule is going to be the same rule. And that is that the note holder can only take the lesser of those two monies. Therefore, he can only take 100, not 120.
If it's the same principle, why not?
Yeah, the Mishnah just wants to make sure that, in other words, I guess it's a havamina. I'm articulating a havamina. The Gemara doesn't say this. I'm saying this, and it could very well be that maybe you would have given stronger consideration to the word sela over the zuz. Maybe. But the point of the Mishnah is that you don't. Now, kesef zuzin de'inon. Okay, now let's say the contract says like this. I lent the man zuzin. Now, that is plural. That means I lent him more than one zuz. But then you expect the number to be read after that point in time, v'nimchak. But there is no number. It's erased. Okay, so somehow the number got erased. Okay, who did it? You know. At this point in time, how that happened is unimportant. What is important, however, is that the note holder wants to get money, get paid. But right now, there is no number. So All I know is that he owes me coins. He says, it says Zuzin, but it doesn't mention a number. So we go back to, again, our, another basic rule. And that is that when there's a plurality and I don't know what the number is, we're going to take the most conservative approach, which is that it's two. I mean, once you say it's more than two, it could be any number. This is a principle of tafas meru below tafasta. So here, we'll assume it's two. Ein pachus mishtayim. So therefore, the note holder is going to be awarded two, but that's it, just two. Kesef salayim de'inon. Again, it's the same exact idea. It's that in the Mishnah over here is using the word kesef salayim. Silver sellas. So, v'nimchak. And once again, we're expecting to read a number, but the number has been erased. Ein pachus mishtayim. So, but you are going to get two salayim. Darkonos de'inon. The darkon is a larger currency. The darkon is valued at two salayim. But again, doesn't say how much. V'nimchak ein pachus mishtayim. So then, again, same idea. You're going to get two darkonos. Okay. And the last case of the Mishnah goes as follows. Kasev bo melamala mana. Milamata Masayim. Now here's another discrepancy that exists in a document where I'm reading the contract. Now the contract a couple of times mentions the loan amount. The only problem is that the first time on the top of the document where it mentions the loan amount, it gives one number, and then as we get towards the bottom of the document, it mentions a different number. Okay. So the Mishnah says over here, now it's funny, if we're going to base it on what we learned earlier in the Mishnah, so then I would have said, you would have said, or at least I'll speak for myself, I would have said, well, then he's only awarded the lesser of the two numbers. Interesting, though, and that's not the case over here. If there's a discrepancy between the way the number is represented in the top of the document versus the bottom of the document, the Mishnah says the bottom is the more significant number. So... let me read inside. Kasuba milamala, mana, milamata masayim, milamala masayim, milamata mana, and it doesn't matter which is the bigger of the two numbers. Hakol holech achatachta, we're always going to follow the number that is expressed at the end of the document. Question. Simple question. Why? Why are we gonna follow the number expressed at the bottom of the document. So the truth of the matter is the Mishnah does not make this point clearly. I tell you even more, more full disclosure. The Rashbam also doesn't explain it. The Gemara doesn't explain it. The Rashbam doesn't explain it. But probably the reason why is because we assume that if the number is expressed in the contract multiple times, we assume that the last time that it is mention is the most significant, probably because perhaps it was a retraction of what was stated earlier. Now, quite frankly, we're not talking over here. This is all in written text. And if it's proofed and it's edited, so then why would you need to retract? Just simply erase and rewrite it. So admittedly, what I'm arguing is possible, but I can only say this for sure. The Mishnah says very clearly that we go with the lower number. When I say lower, I mean not lesser. I mean the number that's expressed on the bottom of the contract as opposed to the number that's expressed on the top of the contract.
Maybe because the bottom of the shtar is a review of
right.
before, so therefore
right.
you put more significance.
Could be, again, right. I'm with you. In other words, we're trying to articulate why this should be, but it is. In other words, it's certainly so. Also, another point to consider, and the Rashbam makes this point, and I'm just now reiterating what the Rashbam is saying, we're not talking about the last line of the contract. It can't be the last line of the contract. Remember, a couple of days ago, the Gemara at length discussed how there is nothing to be learned by the last line of the contract. The last line of the contract is by design not supposed to give us any new information. So even though the Mishnah over here is talking about a number at the bottom of the contract, it means bottom means towards the bottom, but not the very bottom, because ein lamedim in shita achrona, we don't learn out from that last line of the contract. So imkein lamakosim es elyon. So question now, ask the Mishnah. So I have now a possibility of two different numbers, a number at the top of the contract and a number at the bottom of the contract, and hopefully there's agreement between the two numbers and then we could just move on. But if there's disagreement between the top and the bottom, so the Mishnah says we're always going to favor the number on the expressed on the bottom of the document as opposed to the number on the top of the document. And then the Mishnah says, well, if that's true, then what's the point? why would I even write a number towards the top of the document if anyway any number expressed at the bottom is going to be the more significant number, the one that's actually reckoned with? So the Gemara says, look, in terms of discrepancy, Tachton is going to beat Elyon. That's clear. But in terms of omission, meaning, so let's say in the bottom of the document it actually states, and I owe you this much money, but it doesn't give a number. Or let's say the number's a little bit smudged. It's a little bit unclear. What I can then do is I can go to the top of the document, see the number over there, and use that as the number. Meaning, if it's a discrepancy, the bottom number is going to be the top number. But if it's an omission, so I'll allow the top of the document to supplement that which is in the bottom of the document. Okay, so so far we have gone through the Mishnah. The Mishnah gave us a number of examples of what to do with ambiguity in the contract, specifically if there is inconsistency in numbers. So if the inconsistent numbers are right next to one another, so I go with the lesser of the number. If, let's say, there's no number expressed in the contract, but it says in the plurality, then we go with the number two. If we have towards the top of the document says one number, towards the bottom of the document says another number, I always go with the bottom as opposed to the top. That's the Mishnah, that's the review. Let's start with the Gemara. Tanu Rabbanan, the Gemara starts off with the Braisa. Amar Kesef. So let's say in the contract it says that the borrower is owing lender Kesef. The word Kesef, and that's it, just the word Kesef. Now, in modern parlance, in the way we talk, Kesef is a reference to money. So what you have to do is you just kind of have to scrap that out of your system. Take that out of your system. Let's go with the word kesef in the Mishnaic sense and the biblical sense. Okay, what is kesef? Kesef is silver. Now, true, they did make their coins out of silver. Most of the coins back then were made out of silver. Three metals, we discussed this time and again. Three metals are used to make up coins back in the good old days. Copper, silver, gold. And, generally speaking, the smaller coins were made out of copper, the medium-sized coins were made out of silver, and the larger coins were made out of gold. That's, generally speaking, how it worked. So, but in the contract itself, it says, the only thing it says is kesef, the word kesef. Now, the word kesef by itself just simply means silver. So, now what is owed from the borrower to the lender, where this is the only word that's expressed in the shtar? So, ein pachus midinar kesef, so a silver coin. We assume the word kesef is a reference to a coin, specifically dinar kesef, a silver coin. And again, reviewing, we've done this also many times before, is that their coins back then were actually based on the metal content. Meaning that, right, we used to operate this way in America as well, until, you know, pretty recently, where, in other words, the metal content itself represented the actual value of the coin. So to say that a silver coin of a dinar actually had a particular weight and amount of silver in it. So, because the word kesef was used, and we're going to make a leap of assumption that it refers to coins, so therefore it's going to be dinar kesef. Now, kesef dinarim. V'dinarim kesef. Now, let's say the words in the contract are kesef dinarim, dinarim kesef. It doesn't matter which order it comes in, ein pachus mishnei dinarim kesef, but because the plurality is used, so therefore we assume it means two silver coins. Again, that was a point already taught to us by our Mishnah, but this is a Braisa. And yes, obviously there's overlap between what we just learned and what we learned back in the Mishnah. Kesef bidinarin. Okay, here's a tough one. The language of the contract says, kesef silver bidinarim, using dinarim in order to pay that obligation. So here, clear ambiguity. Like that? I made up that term. It's clearly ambiguous, this kind of terminology. What does it mean? Kesef bidinarim. So, ein pachos mi bishnei dinarim dahav kesef. So, in terms of how much is going to be paid, two gold coins, but paid in the form of kesef using silver coinage. Okay. Okay, fine. So that's the end of this Braisa. Amar. Now, right now, the Gemara is going to reflect on one of the things that the Braisa taught us. Kesef ein pachos midinari kesef. That when it says kesef, we assume it's coins. Ve'ema nascha. Gemara's question over here is so simple, straightforward. The only word that's used in the contract is the word kesef. It doesn't say what kind of coin. It doesn't say which coin. It just simply says the word kesef. And again, not going with our modern parlance, but going with the time of the Mishnah, the time of the in the time of the Torah, kesef just simply means silver. And so could it not be that when the note actually says that you owe me silver, silver could just simply mean silver. Meaning, now I don't know if they had a standard bar of what silver would be, but in other words, why are we necessarily suggesting that it's a reference to a silver coin? Can it just simply be silver?
How much silver?
And right. And of course, that only begs the question, how much? But again, the fact that the contract is not clear about this point, so, and again, we always say, Amotz mechaver olav araya, so why do we make the leap of assumption that's talking about a silver coin? So I'm Rebbe Lazer Dikasa Bei Matbea. So Rebbe Lazer gives more context, and he says that it has to be talking about a case where the contract actually also includes the word matbea. Somewhere in the contract it says coins. So now we know, we take the word silver, take the word coin, and that's how we know that's a reference to a silver coin. Ve'ema priti. So the Gemara says, well, maybe it's a pruta, meaning the fact that we're saying that it's a dinar is assuming that it's valued at a lot. In other words, a dinar is a significant amount of silver. And maybe not, maybe it's a pruta, right? Like what we would call a penny. But in other words, a much smaller coin. The problem is the contract didn't mention which kind of coin it was. So why don't we assume now it's a smaller coin? And again, hamotz mechaver olav araya. So amar papa basta lo sagi pruta de kaspa. So Rav Papa says that no, we're talking about a community where the prutos, those very small coins, are not made out of silver, but rather made out of copper. It almost sounds as if there are communities that make prutos out of silver. Meaning the Gemara entertains the idea, and the Gemara says, no, we're talking about where in our community we don't do that. Sounds like from the Gemara that there are communities that do that. Tosos is bothered by that. The bottom Tosos over here that goes into the beginning of today's daf. And Tosos has a difficulty with that because generally speaking, throughout Shas, we always assume that a pruta is made out of copper. And there's no such thing, so to say, as a silver pruta. But anyway, okay. But that ends that brisa. So far in the brisa we just learned together, same basic idea, an ambiguity. So we assume, we always take the most conservative interpretation. Conservative meaning from the perspective of the borrower. The lender's trying to take money away from the borrower. The contract itself is not super clear about what was actually lent. And so therefore we're going to take the most minimalistic interpretation in favor of the borrower. Tana Rabbanan, the Gemara is now going to do the same thing again. It's almost an identical brisa. Let's go through it. Dahav ein pachus midinar dahav. If the contract says the word gold, and that's the only thing that it says, it says gold. So we assume dinar dahav, one golden coin. Dahav dinarim v'dinarim dahav, ein pachus mishnei dinarim. So if it says the words dahav dinarim, so therefore it's going to be two golden coins. Again, it says it in its plural form. It doesn't say how much. We always take a conservative approach. It has to be, it's not going to be greater than two. Now, dahav bid din. I'm sorry, mishnei dinarim dahav, comma. Dahav bid dinarim, if it says gold using dinarim. So now this one again has ambiguity. Gold using dinarim. Ein pachus mi bishnei dinarim kesef dahav. So here is how we're going to interpret it. We're going to interpret it to mean that the word dinarim is silver coins. Two silver coins, but paid in gold. Meaning using the gold currency to pay that amount. But in terms of how much it is, it's going to be valued at two silver coins. Okay. Now, once again, We're going to come back to that point in just a couple of minutes from now. But once again, the Gemara is going to go and reflect on the same question, the same answer that we asked in the previous brisa. Previous brisa, we were talking about silver. This brisa, we're talking about gold. But the question is essentially the same. The Gemara asks, Amamar, dahav ein pachus midinar zahav, ema naska. And again, the Gemara's question is, well, again, the contract only says the word dahav. It says gold. But it doesn't say gold coins. So once again, how do I know it's referencing a gold coin? Couldn't it just simply be a gold, meaning like just pieces of gold? To which the Gemara says, the Amar Avalaz, the Kasav Matbeah. Okay, so the Rav Lazar says that in the contract itself, it also includes the word matbea, so therefore we know it's referring to coins. Top of Kuf Samech Vav Amud Aleph Ve'ema Priti. The Gemara says
is worth 25
silver dinar.
So how can you pay 2 dinar
right.
with a matbea from gold?
Maybe it's not a matbea.
Gold is 25.
Your question is excellent. Maybe it's not a matbea of gold. Maybe it's just metal, meaning it could be just the metal.
That's no.
No, the Gemara is asking on the first case of the Braisa. The first case of the Braisa just simply says the word Dahav, and that's it. And the Gemara's question is, well, maybe it's just pieces of gold. How do I know it's a golden coin? So Rabbi Lazar's answer, which was it was the same answer in the previous Braisa, it says the word Matbea in the contract.
There is no golden coin that's worth.
That's the next case in the Braisa. The Gemara is not dealing with that case right now. The Gemara is dealing with the first case of the Braisa, where it just says the word Dahav. Okay. The Ema Priti. So the Gemara says, again, same question. Couldn't it be referencing a pruta? Meaning a golden pruta? Again, that's obviously it's a much smaller coin. And again, the Gemara's answer is Prita Dahav Lo Avdi Inshi. Here the Gemara says nobody does it. Like, no, nobody takes gold and turns it into a small little pruta. Again, the basic idea is that prutas were made generally out of copper. The larger coin is made out of silver, and even the larger coin is made out of gold. So, and nobody does that, and therefore it is just simply an untenable interpretation of the contract. And so therefore, when it says the word gold, and it says coin, so we assume that's referring to a golden dinar. Okay. Zahab dinarim. In Pachos, maybe shnei dinarim kesev zahav. Okay. We now turn to the third case of the second Braisa, the golden. There are two Braisas. There's the silver Braisa and the gold Braisa. Okay, sounds like we're in the Olympics. So there's the silver Braisa and there's the gold Braisa. So now the structure of both Braisas are basically the same. Are not basically, they are the same. Meaning, first the first case was the word kesef or the word zahav. The second case was plurality. And the third case was kesef bidinarim and zahav bidinarim. So now we're in the gold braisa. And the Gemara is reflecting on the third case of the gold braisa. Zahav bidinarim. So I say that I'm going to pay you gold bidinarim. Now, in pachos mi b'shnei dinarim kesef, zahav. So, what is now the interpretation of that going to be? It's going to be that I, the borrower, owe you the value of 2 silver coins, but I'm going to pay to you in gold. Now, ve'ema dahava prichi betray dinari dahava ka'amar. Now, the Gemara says, now, I could give another interpretation, which is that it's really the value of 2 golden coins, which is significantly greater in value. So, and that is another possible interpretation of the Braisa. Amar Abaye Yad Balashtar Tachtona. So Abaye says, yeah, but we're going to keep reiterating and hammering this point again and again. Which is, yes, that is a fair interpretation of what is meant in the contract. But it's only an interpretation, it's not the interpretation. And given that we have now multiple interpretations, we are going to say that the note holder is not in the driver's seat. And why? Because the note holder is owed the money and is extracting the money from somebody else. Now, admittedly, by the way, I know this is a little bit difficult because at one point in time, the note holder was the owner of the money. In fact, the note holder lent the money to this person. But I understand. But still, at this point in time, meaning right now, if we were to take a snapshot, the note holder is extracting money from the borrower. His raya is the shtar. The shtar has language which is ambiguous. We are not going to award the note holder the larger interpretation, but rather we're only going to award him the more minimalistic interpretation of the contract. And so therefore, if it says dinarin, even though in this context you could interpret as 2 golden coins, we're not. We're going to interpret as 2 silver coins. Paid in gold. Okay, next 2.5 lines of the Gemara is the Bach says take it out, and we are going to just insert two words. The Bach does either words ihachi, if this is so, emaresha. Why don't we go to the first brisa? Meaning, let's now compare notes. I mean that here literally. Let's compare the gold brisa with the silver brisa. So in the case of the gold brisa, when the word dinarim was used, so we say it's two silver coins just paid in gold. In the first brisa, it says kesef bidinarim. And how do we interpret that? Kesef bidinarin. So the it's going to be two golden coins paid in silver. So now, once again, that's that silver brisa, the first brisa, that's really difficult. Meaning, didn't you just tell me that? If there are two possible interpretations of how to understand the language of the contract. So the rule is going to be that whichever one is going to work in favor of the borrower is the one we're going to use. Well, that's not what happened the first brisa. In the first brisa, when it said kesef bidinarim, oh, you know what? He owes him two golden coins just paid in silver. The Gemara says, what's going on? So that's the ihachi emaresha. And then skip the parentheses, amar Rav Ashi. Resha dekasef dinarei, save dekasef dinarim. So the Gemara now is going to give an answer, and basically it's a very technical answer, but the Gemara is going to give an answer in that. In the resha, it says the words dinarei, without the nun sophis. In the second brice, in the golden brice, it says the words dinarin with a nun at the end. And, again, to us, none of this speaks to us. This is not how we communicate. But in the time of the Mishnah, time of the Gemara, that made the difference between silver and gold. And the word dinare without a nun at the end means gold. The word dinarin with a nun at the end means silver. And the Gemara says, and how do I know? Meaning, what evidence do we have? What Mishnaic evidence? What Bryce evidence do we have that such a distinction of with or without a nun is the difference between silver and gold? So the Gemara has now a Bryce, and the Bryce over here, although it's going to take us on a wild tangent, but the entire purpose of citing this brisa, quoting this brisa, is just to show with clear proof, with clear evidence, that dinare without a nun at the end is a reference to gold, dinarin with a nun at the end is a reference to silver. Okay, so join me please as we now take a we're now going to go off topic, well off topic, and we're now going to be discussing an issue regarding women, karbanos, and again, just not to lose the forest, all we're doing over here is just demonstrating the difference between dinare versus dinarin. Okay, a little bit of background over here, if I may. A woman gives birth, it's a big simcha, it's a big mazel tov, and she also needs to bring a carbon as well. Okay, you open up at the beginning of Parshas Tazria, so there you'll see the Torah articulate exactly her carbon requirement once she gives birth. She brings shtei torim shnei bnei yona. She brings a pair of birds. One is going to be a chatas, the other one's going to be an olo. The Gemara elsewhere asks the question: why is she bringing a carbon chatas? She gave birth. Doesn't sound like a sin. Sounds like a good thing. It is a good thing. First mitzvah in the Torah. So why is she bringing a carbon chatas? Not for our discussion now. Not for now. All we need to know are just simply the facts on the ground. Facts on the ground is that she needs to bring a pair of birds. And we also know that until she brings a pair of birds, she is now what's called in halacha mechusre kapara, which means that she herself cannot eat any karbanos until she brings a pair of birds. When does she bring the pair of birds? So if she had a boy, she brings it 40 on the 41st day subsequent to the birth. If she had a girl, she brings it on the 81st day subsequent to the birth. I mean, she could bring it at a later point in time, but her earliest opportunity to bring it would be on the 81st day subsequent to the birth. Okay. If she had, let's say, a second baby, so then she'd have to bring another carbon. If she had a third baby, she had to bring a third carbon, meaning regardless of the number of babies that she had, not regardless, but, wrong word, I'm editing myself. Commensurate to the number of babies that she has, that's the number of pairs of birds that she needs to bring to the Beis HaMikdash. Okay, another word of introduction. A woman has a cycle of 7-11. 7 days are what's called Yemei Nida, and 11 days are Yemei Ziva. Meaning that if we were to start at, let's just simply call it the beginning of the menstrual cycle. So the beginning of the menstrual cycle, so a woman for those next 7 days, so with the expectation that she's menstruating, so therefore the blood that comes out is what's described and defined as Dam Nida. The next 11 days, where if she were to bleed, she's not expected to bleed during those next 11 days. But if she were to bleed during those days, so that blood has a different definition, different designation. It's called Dam Ziva. Now, if she bleeds during those days, those next 11 days, she's not a Nida, she's a Zava. It's a different category. Now, bizmanenu, nowadays, we don't differentiate between dam nida and dam ziva. We don't do it. But in the time of the Torah, in the time of the Mishnah, in the time of the Gemara, so this differentiation was made. Now, if she bleeds on three consecutive days during her Yemei Ziva, during this 11-day period, so so she is what's referred to in Halacha as a Zava Gedola, where, at which point in time, she has to now count seven clean days, Shiv and Akiyim, and then on the eighth day, she brings a carbon. And again, it's the same basic idea, where, until she brings a carbon, she's what's called a Mechusra Kapara, and she herself cannot go into the Beis HaMikdash nor eat carbonos until she brings her carbon. Okay, and again, it's the same idea that we expressed regarding the delivery of a baby, in that, if let's say she was a Zava Gadola, she has to bring a carbon. If she was a Zava Gadola a second time, she has to bring another carbon, and it keeps racking up the number of carbonos commensurate to the number of times she is a Zava Gadola. So far, so good. That's all the basic background information we need to know.
Really?
Yes.
Because what she can't eat, if she's the wife of a Kohen, could she eat Maser and...
Can she eat truma? No. In other words, mechusrei kapara cannot eat truma as well. So she will be...
That's tough for her.
Yeah. In other words, if she had a girl, that's right. That's 80 days.
Yeah.
That's agreed. So a woman who had five births, but each birth was a suffix. Suffix in this case means that it was not clear whether what came out of her was a fetus or just some sort of amniotic fluid, some sort of whatever, something that came out of her that was not a fetus. It was unclear what came out of her, and so therefore she's in the status of being a suffix. Now, and suffix hamishivas, and the same thing is true regarding a zava, where she bled on three consecutive days, but she was not sure whether she lost count. She did not keep a good accounting of where she was regarding the 7 versus the 11. She bled three consecutive days. Could have been dam ziva, could have been dam nida. She wasn't sure. So, under these circumstances, so here you have a tension, and the tension basically is this: like this. On one hand, in order to bring a carbon to the base of mikdash, there has to be cause. If there's no cause, then you can't bring a carbon to the Beis HaMikdash. On the other hand, she herself is going to be restricted from eating carbonos until she brings a carbon. So you have this tension, where on one hand, we don't want to bring a carbon to the Beis HaMikdash if she's not required to do so. On the other hand, she herself is going to be restricted until she brings a carbon. What do you do? Mevi carbon echa v'ochelz b'zvachim v'ein ashar alechova. So, here's what you do. You bring one carbon, because the one carbon will remove her restriction, and she will therefore be allowed to eat carbonos going forward. But don't bring the other four sets of carbonos, because we don't know if they need to be brought. Fine. And I know there are technical issues over here, meaning this one carbon that she brought may or may not be a carbon. And because of that, what are the Kohanim going to be doing in terms of the consumption of this particular carbon? Okay, I don't want to discuss that right now. We're anyway deep into a tangent. Let's continue. If there were five definitive births or five definitive zivas, where now she is absolutely required to bring five pairs of carbonos. So, the first carbon that she brings, meaning, and they all racked up, meaning we're talking about where... Whatever, she was just delinquent in terms of bringing the carbon, so now she has five sets of carbonos she's obligated to bring. So after the first one she brings, so that removes the restriction. Her restriction, she's now allowed to eat carbon. But she's still on the hook to owe the other four. So far, so good. Maisa. The Gemara then, the Brisa then tells us about the following episode. V'amdukinim b'yushalayim b'dinari zahav. The price of birds in Yerushalayim skyrocketed. Now, generally speaking, as we've discussed many times before, the Chachamim left it as a free market environment. And so therefore the market demands whatever you're going to pay for an item. However, sometimes there were spikes in the market, and what the Chachamim did on rare occasion, is that they influenced the market. And obviously they will do so, obviously, to protect the consumer. So here's a good example. Here's a really good example where, so the birds in Yerushalayim spiked. the price of birds, I should say, spiked. So to buy a pair of birds was dinaris of, was a golden coin. And as we pointed out earlier today, a golden coin is valued at 25 silver coins. It was an exorbitant price for a pair of birds. And if a woman now had to come to the Beis HaMikdash to offer five pairs of birds, so that would be financially painful. So, Amar Rav Shimon Gamliel Hamonos says, Rav Shimon Gamliel says, okay, buy this temple, buy the Beis HaMikdash. Im alin halayla, I'm not going to bed tonight. Ashu bidinarim, until it's dinarin. And basically, you can now just focus all your attention on the word that I just read in the Braisa. In other words, I want the price to go from dinarei to dinarin. This is it. The entire reason why we brought this Braisa over here is just to highlight the difference that dinarei is a reference to gold, and dinarin, with a nun at the end, is a reference to silver. Okay. But we're here, so we're going to finish the sentence. Nichnas the Beis Din v'limeid. So what did Rav Shimon ben Gamliel do? He went into the Beis Medrash, and he started popularizing the following halacha. Ha'isha shayu ala chamesh leidos v'ados, chamesh yivos v'ados, mevi'a karbenecha v'alchaz b'zvachim, v'ein hashar ala chova. When a woman is on the hook to bring five karbanos, either because she gave birth five times definitively, or she was a zava gedola five times definitively, so she only needs to bring a pair of birds, and the remaining is not an obligation. And so basically what Rav Shimon Gamliel did is he went to the Beis HaMikdash, he introduced a halacha. Now, in terms of the question, really a powerful question, is this in fact the halacha? And if it's not in fact the halacha, so how can he expound something which is not in fact the halacha, even though, of course, the purpose of him doing so is wonderful. He's driving the price down to protect the consumer. But if this is not the halacha, how can he do that? That's a powerful question. I know it's a powerful question. But he did. So right now I'll let the question sit, even though, you know, it obviously demands an answer. But I'll let the question sit. And meanwhile, that's what he did. So he went and he started telling people that you only need to bring one. If you're on the hook for five, you only need to bring one. Drives demand down. First thing we learned in economics, the only thing I remember from economics, is that once the demand goes down, the price is going to go down. And v'amdu kinem bobayom b'riv asayim. And in fact, the price dropped so precipitously that it went down to a quarter of a silver dinar. So in other words, it was at 25 silver dinarim, and it went down all the way to one quarter of a silver dinar. Now, mission accomplished. Okay. Anyway, and again, the whole reason why we quoted it over here is just simply to accentuate this idea that the dinarium with a nun is silver, and dinare without a nun is gold. And that explains, and all that was to explain, the discrepancy between the first brisa and the second brisa that we did in the beginning of today's shir. Meaning in the first brisa, when it said the word dinare, we assume it meant golden coins, even though that is to the detriment of the borrower. And in the second brisa, we assume it means silver coins, and because it says dinarium with a nun. Let's continue. We're in Kuf Samech Vav Amud Beis. We're towards the top of the Amud Kasov Milamala. Okay, we're talking now about the discrepancy between that which was written on the top of the contract versus towards the bottom of the contract. Tana Rabbanon, the Gemara quotes a Braisa. Yilamid Atachtam and Elyon Bo'osachas Avalobishtei Osios. Here is an example where we're going to learn the bottom from the top. Okay, so remember we discussed this at the beginning of today's shir, that a discrepancy between that which is written on the top of the document versus the bottom of the document, we give more credence to that which is on the bottom of the document. In fact, when I say more credence, meaning if there's a perfect discrepancy between the bottom and the top, the bottom is going to be considered the ikker. The top is going to be considered the tofo. So, Yalamid Atachim and Elyon Ba'osachas Avalobishte Osios. So, here's an example where I'm going to learn the bottom from the top regarding a discrepancy of one letter but not two letters. Kigon. Let's say, for example, Chanan Chanani. Anan Anani. The name of the borrower, the lender, whichever one, was written two different ways, two different times. One place it was written Chanan, and the other way it was written Chanani. One place it was written Anan, and the other one it was written Anani. We're going to say like this. It's only a one-letter discrepancy, and even though it's a one-letter discrepancy, but we'll basically assume that The actual name is Hanani, and the fact that it was written on the bottom, Hanan, like a contraction, if you will. Okay, in other words, almost as if by the end of the contract, like we know each other so well, you know, I'll call you by your nickname, even though no one ever gave you that nickname before. So, Maishna Shtei Osios Delo, Deloma Misrami Shem, Ben Arba Osios. So the Gemara says, now, what's wrong with the two-letter discrepancy? So the Gemara says, well, what's wrong with the two-letter discrepancy is that if the name was four letters and now I've reduced it down to two letters, that's basically I chopped off half the name. And the Gemara says that's too great a discrepancy. So the Gemara says, Ihachi osachas nami domen misram Hashem ben shtei osios. So the Gemara says, well, if the issue is reducing his name in half, so the Gemara says, well, if that's true, so if, let's say, the name starts off as a two-letter name, my name is a two-letter name, Dov, so if the name starts off as a two-letter name, by knocking off just but one letter, so you basically now chop the name in half. So the Gemara says, if the issue is that two letters represent half his name, well, one letter sometimes can also represent half your name if your name is two letters. So Ella, Shtei Osios Hanotayma, Dilma Misrami, Shem Ben Shlosh Osios, Vavalei Ruba Deshma. So the Gemara says, oh, so it has to do with not the fact that you're chopping in half, but basically a majority. Meaning, two out of three is going to be the majority of his name. So as long as you have majority of it reflected in the bottom, so then we'll allow the top to tell us what the missing letter, so to say, on the bottom. Amar Rav Papa, Pshita li sefel malamala v'kefel malamata. Okay, Rav Papa says here, I'm going to look at the following discrepancy in a contract, where on the top it says sefel is a bowl, and on the bottom it says kefel. Kefel is an article of clothing. Okay. And the reason why kefel is an article of clothing, says the Rashbam, is because the word kefel means to fold. And generally speaking, clothing is folded. Okay. Rashbam gives another suggestion, but the Rashbam does not like that other suggestion. Anyway, hakol holech achar tachton. So over here, in other words, so we're not talking about a monetary loan. We're talking about where I lent him an article, but what I lent him is subject to a discrepancy in the contract itself. Seifel versus kefel. So hakol holech achar tachton. So Rav Papa says once again, we're going to give credence to that which is written on the bottom of the document as opposed to the top of the document. By Rav Papa, kefal malamala v'sefal malamata mai. So let's say it said kefal above and it said sefal below. So once again, it's a discrepancy, and over here it's a one letter discrepancy. It's not even. When we say one letter, meaning they both have a letter, it's just that in the first time on the document it is with a kuf, and the second time it's with a samach. So mi chayshin lezvavolo. So the Gemara says, now here's a possible explanation, in that both times the word kefal was written. Now the difference between a kuf and a samach is not that big a difference. And again, we're talking about block letters, so really, it's basically a square. It's that the kuf has a couple of openings in the square, right? If you're with me, in other words, it'd be better if I draw it out. But if you're with me, there's a small opening towards the bottom. There's a small opening on the left, on the top left-hand side. But, and the kuf also has a tail extending downward. Okay. The samach, however, is a perfect square. Could it not be, I mean, I understand this is a little bit far-fetched, but could it not be that what happened was that really both times the word kefal was written? And what happened was is that a bug landed on the kuf before it dried. And so therefore, the bug took that little small tail of ink off the bottom of the kuf, and it could, and it's possible, admittedly unlikely, that really in both times it actually said the word kefal, not kefal versus sefal. Teiku, interestingly enough, the Gemara leaves this question unresolved, meaning I don't know. So, and therefore, what is he on the hook for? Is he on the hook of having to give back clothing or a bowl? So the Gemara says, I don't know. And with an I don't know, what do we do? So I turn to the Rashbam over here, and the Rashbam addresses this very question. And the Rashbam writes, Hamotze mechaver ala varaya. So once again, the note holder is trying to extract something from the person, borrower, if you will. And we don't know. Kevin de Mistafik, Dina le Beidina, And we don't know what to take, and there. Yeah, in other words, yeah, that would be good. In other words, if the witnesses can provide information, that would be a riot. That'd be a proof.
Find an ink-stained book.
Right. That'd be another that'd be another proof. Now, the Rashbam deals with the following. So basically now, I have a discrepancy in the contract itself, meaning I know he owes them, and I know he owes them either a bowl, which is, I guess, inexpensive, or an article of clothing, which is more expensive. Why not split the difference? The Rashbam says we're not going to do that. V'lo dami l'mamana muta basafik dekai malan chokin. Now the Rashbam. Now we are towards the end of Baba Basra. Like we know, here's what we know. We know that Simchas and the Chachamim argue about money that's muta basafik, whether you divide it or whether you don't divide it. We also know, interestingly enough, the Rashbam favors the opinion of Simchas. He's done it many times in this Masechta, and here's another example where he favors Simchas's opinion. So now that I know that the Rashbam favors Simchas' opinion, so over here, why not? Why not split the difference? I don't know if I owe him a bowl or a shirt. The contract itself reflects both languages. I could explain the discrepancy of the languages, but again, we're giving a very far-fetched explanation. So why not say, "Motzi mechaver olav
araya"?
Okay. So the Rashbam says, I'll tell you where I am favoring the idea of splitting the difference. In a case where it is inherently a case of doubt, like where the beginning of the fourth paragraph of Baba Kama, where an ox gores a pregnant cow, and I don't know whether or not it miscarried before or after the Negicha. So there, I literally don't know what happened. Or the house fell on top of two people. We did this recently, and two people died, and the order of death is significant, and I just simply don't know. And we're never going to know. So those are cases where they're inherent cases of doubt. The Rashbam says those are examples where we're going to split the difference. Hilkach poskin lahem beis and esadin shiachloku. Ava kol makum sha'ata halacha b'teku hova ina dayanim yodim lefsok esadin hayu shotkin v'amachzik yachzik v'mashi b'yado. But here it's a halachic discussion, meaning what's the actual case. Somebody knows the truth, meaning it's like, you know, the old show, The X-Files. The truth is out there, meaning, right, there was something left lent from the lender to the borrower, and now he's trying to get it back. But over here, though, the discrepancy in the language of the contract, but the truth is out there. So the Rashbam says, under these circumstances, I will not say, and in terms of the halacha, we're not sure, meaning the Gemara says teiku, meaning the halacha is left unresolved. So under these circumstances, the Rashbam says, now I'm going to go back on the principle of Amotz Mechaver Lav Araya. I don't know what the halacha is, and now I'm trying to extract money out of somebody else, so therefore I'm not going to split the difference.
Why not apply the principle of Modu Mixa? And I have the lent borrower make it take a shiva.
I see.
Think that it at least half the value of this.
Right. Interesting. Okay. It's an interesting suggestion. I don't know. Okay.
Why didn't they just follow the second one and they do as the Mishnah says?
The Mishnah.
The scripture you follow the second. Why would this case be different?
Because we have a possible, albeit improbable, but we have a possible explanation of the discrepancy. Now, the bug landing on
discrepancy affects the bottom one.
Right. So we have a possible explanation, albeit it's an implausible explanation, but it's a possible explanation. Meaning, but you're right. If there is no way to resolve the top and the bottom is always going to win. But if there's a possibility of resolving it, so then we may go with this resolution. But the Gemara says teiku. The Gemara says I don't know. And again, and the Rashbam just simply explains that I generally like splitting the difference. Why won't I split the difference over here? So the Rashbam says, okay, point well taken. Okay, let's just quickly recap. So tomorrow we'll start off with more of this discussion. So again, the Mishnah talked about various discrepancies that exist within a document or omissions, right? Commissions and omissions. Or omissions that exist in a document. So what do I do? So the Mishnah treats us to some basic rules regarding. If there's a discrepancy in number, 80 versus 100, 100 versus 120, so we award the note holder is always going to be not in the driver's seat, but I guess in the back seat, if you will. He's trying to extract money from somebody, so you only take the smaller of the two. An omission where the number itself is not mentioned, so if it's plural, so we assume two but no more than two. And finally, if there is a top portion of the contract and the bottom portion of the contract, we always give more weight and credence to the bottom portion of the contract than that of the top portion of the contract. What's the point of them writing a top portion of a contract? The top portion of the contract will allow us to fill in a blank later on. But if it's a discrepancy, the bottom is always going to be at the top. The Bryces we discussed today, Bryces regarding silver, Bryces regarding gold, a seeming discrepancy between the Bryces, and the Gemara says that when it says dinare without a nun, it's referencing gold, dinarin with a nun is referencing silver, and we went on a lengthy tangent where the Bryce regarding a woman and her obligation to bring karbanos made very clear this distinction between dinare versus dinarin. And finally, we finished up today with this idea of a discrepancy in names. A one-letter discrepancy, the Gemara says, is not a big deal, but a two-letter discrepancy already is a significant deal. The difference between one versus two is majority. Meaning, of a three-letter name, of a two-letter discrepancy, so then you lost the majority of that name. And finally, we have ended up today with a really, really small discrepancy in lettering between the word seifel and the word kefel, a possibility of giving an explanation of such a small discrepancy in lettering, a far-fetched explanation of maybe a bug landed on it, but it is possible. Gemara says, are we going to entertain that possibility? The Gemara leaves this question unresolved, and the Rashbam says, and we're going to fall back on the basic rule of, Hamotzi mechaver al avarai.